shows you how shallow this whole policy was. It wasn't about bettering the plight of the Iraqi people. It wasn't about eliminating a threat to international peace and security. It was about solving a domestic political problem for the President of the United States. Now, silly weapons inspectors, we didn't know any of this. We thought when they passed a resolution under Chapter 7, especially one drafted by the United States, voted in favor of by the United States, that somehow they were serious about the issue of disarmament. So we took our job seriously. We went into Iraq. Now, the Iraqis were required under this resolution to submit a declaration listing the totality of their holdings of weapons of mass destruction. That's the name of the game. We weapons inspectors came in. I wasn't part of the process at the time, and I'll tell you why. When you're going to get rid of chemical weapons, what do you need? A chemist. If you check my resume, you're not going to find any reference to a chemist on it. You want to get rid of biological weapons, you need a biologist. I'm not one of those either. You want to get rid of ballistic missiles, you need a rocket scientist. You want to get rid of nuclear weapons, bring in a nuclear physicist. No, no, not me. But they were a whole bunch of these guys at the beginning. You know the type that wear lab coats, have thin necks, pale skin because they're never outdoors. Well, they're the ones that we brought to Iraq early on because their job was to do the technical disarmament. Iraq was supposed to submit the totality of its holdings, and these smart people come in, verify that they're there, check them off, and destroy them. But the Iraqis lied. The Iraqis didn't submit weapons, a complete holding. They only submitted half of the weapons that they had. They denied having biological weapons. They denied having nuclear weapons. Now you have a problem. Because if you think about inspections as an engine, and the fuel that makes the engine work is information, we were totally reliant upon, at the beginning, Iraqi fuel, Iraqi information to make the inspection engine work. If the Iraqis submit a false declaration, they basically provided corrupt fuel, bad fuel, and the engine's not going to function. So the inspectors now had to become people who could gain access to new sources of fuel. What does that mean? We need new information. What kind of information? The kind of information the Iraqis are denying us access to. How do you gain access to denied information in denied locations? And now I come into play. You bring in spies. You bring in the practitioners of espionage, the people who know how to go out and do that kind of stuff. That's what I did for a living. For 12 years, I was an intelligence officer who specialized in gaining access to information people didn't want me to gain access to. That was my job in Iraq. But my job in Iraq was to gain access to information that pertained to weapons of mass destruction, to get that good fuel so we can make that inspection engine work so we could disarm Iraq. And you know what? We had pretty good success. I wasn't part of the first success, the big one. In June 1991, though, weapons inspectors, armed with intelligence information, zoomed in on a convoy of 100 vehicles, on the back of which were equipment pertaining to the enrichment of uranium for a nuclear program the Iraqis had denied existed. Remember that thing called the rule of law? The rule of law only works if you're willing to enforce the rule of law. We said Iraq wasn't allowed to have weapons of mass destruction. We said Iraq had to submit a full, final, and complete declaration. And yet we found the Iraqis were lying. They said no nuclear weapons program. We found it on the back of 100 trucks. What did the United Nations do? Hold Iraq accountable? No. No. You see, the United States was still operating under that six-month window. This was June 1991. The CIA said, 6 months, Saddam's gone. The last thing the president wanted to do was engage in military action against Iraq. So even though we caught them red-handed lying, what did the Security Council do? They passed a new resolution. They said, guys, we're sort of serious on this one. You have to submit a declaration that lists the totality of your holdings of weapons of mass destruction. So resubmit. And then they did something very amazing. And a lot of people didn't pick up on this. They shifted the burden of proof, the responsibility of demonstrating where the weapons were, away from Iraq and onto the shoulder of the inspectors. They told the Iraqis they had to provide a declaration listing the totality of the weapons, but then they told the inspectors, you now have to go to Iraq and search for hidden weapons. That means the inspectors had to start searching for the negative, to prove a negative. You can't. The onus is on Iraq to submit a declaration that's full, final, and complete. Why, therefore, do you empower the inspectors to go in and search for hidden weapons? Either the Iraqis submit an accurate declaration or they don't. But by empowering the inspectors to go in and search for hidden weapons, you basically create a situation that can never be resolved, that can never end, because no matter what the Iraqis say, it will always be unacceptable. The inspectors continue to search for something that isn't there. This happened in the summer of 1991. And we inspectors knew that we had a big problem. but we were servants of the United Nations, and we went forward and tried to do our job. And we did a good job. My area was ballistic missiles. In November of 1991, I wrote a report to the United Nations. And I said, look, I believe that the Iraqis are lying about ballistic missiles. I think they got 100 missiles hidden. And I backed it up with analysis. We pushed forward against the Iraqis, and in March of 1992, the Iraqis came clean. A lot like drug dealers. You see, I use this drug analogy. I don't know if Australians have a drug problem, but we got a heck of one in the United States of America. And we have war on drug, in fact. It's about success waging that war on drugs as we are with the war on terror. And but let's say you got a drug dealer. He's got bags of dope that he's trying to peddle out there, and he's selling it out of his house. And the cops come in, knock on the door, and the drug dealer panics and flushes the 10 bags down the toilet. Cop may the drugs, and they go, what drugs? There's drugs here. Got nothing, man. You can search anywhere you want. No drugs. And the cops go, all right. And they go out, and they start doing a forensic analysis. They start looking at videotape, and they talk to people, and they get proof that the drug dealers, 10 bags of drugs in the house. So they go back, and they show the proof. The drug dealer says, you got me. I had 10 bags, but I flushed them down the toilet. So now the cops go into the sewage system and start digging around, and they can find evidence of 8 bags being flushed. 8 bags. They come back and they go, how many bags did you have? Well, where are the other 2? Well, we flushed them. Well, we can only find 8. And because you lied to us, we assume you still have 2 bags of drugs out there. See, this is what happened with Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. They submitted a false declaration, but under pressure from the inspectors in the summer of 1991, they destroyed all their weapons. But they didn't know about it. They buried them under the ground. You know those missiles? They admitted in March of 1992, we destroyed all our weapons. We lied to you. We had the weapons, but we destroyed them. I said, how many missiles? They said, 98. That's pretty close. 100? 98? Not bad. But 98 missiles. Well, we go to Iraq to look for them. We come to a desert field. They drive us out there. We're expecting to see 98 missiles out on the field. And there's nothing there in the desert. Well, where are the missiles? They said, well, we blew them up and we buried them under the ground. So now the inspectors have to become forensic archaeologists. We bring in the bulldozers. We dig up the missile pieces. And these are pieces. These aren't big missiles. And we have to go through piece by piece, getting the serial numbers off the different components. And we assemble list after list after list after list of these serial numbers. Then we go to the Soviet Union. By that time, it's called Russia. The world's a never-changing place. And we go there to the factory that produced the missiles. And we take the serial numbers and we match them with the production logs. So here's a serial. They say, oh, that's for this piece, and that went into this missile. And so we start matching serial number, piece, missile, until we can find 96 of 98 missiles. And we can confirm there are 96 of 98 missiles in the ground. That's good work in anybody's book. We have a bunch of metal over here that might be 2 more missiles, but because the Iraqis lied to us, we can't accept anything they say at face value. They say they destroyed them all. We said, prove it. And they can't. They have the scraps there, but they can't document the destruction. So we only give them credit for 96 of 98. So we still have investigations to do, and we carry out these investigations. Go to Iraq, and we carry out interviews with their senior leadership. We do more forensic examination. We look for documents. And in October of 1992, I come back after carrying out this exhaustive investigation, and I report to the United States intelligence community about the success we had. You see, we finally had enough information that we could say we can account for all the missiles. So I go down to Washington, D.C., and I go to an auditorium. There's about 60 intelligence personnel there. Now, you'd think we're going to be disarming Iraq, right? That's our mission. It's a tough mission. Very tough. And I'm sitting in a room full of people who share the same mission objectives, allegedly. And this is America. We're very emotional people. And I give them the report. Guys, we did it. We're disarming Iraq. We can account for all the missiles. You think I would have gotten that Top Gun response, you know, hats in the air, ooh-hoo, USA, USA. I got icy silence. They didn't want to hear this message. They didn't want to accept this. I can understand why. A week later, I get a 4-page memorandum. It says, we reject your analysis. And while they don't provide me with any justification for the rejection, and we don't believe a thing the Iraqis say, the director of the CIA goes to the United States Senate and said in a public speech that the CIA's estimate is that there's 200 missiles in Iraq. It's mathematically impossible. But it doesn't matter. What do you think the American people are being made aware of? The fact that the United Nations has done an exhaustive search and investigation that found that all missiles are accounted for, or the fact that the director of the CIA has just told them 200? Which headline does the New York Times print? CIA director says there's 200 missiles in Iraq. That becomes the reality. So we as inspectors now have to look for 200 missiles that we know aren't there. So we go to the CIA and say, how did you come up with this number? Where'd you get 200? Too secret. Can't tell you. Thank you very much. A little piece of their secret. They're hiding them on the backs of trucks and moving them around. Now, that's a great one. Iraq is just about the size of the state of California. Let's call it Western Australia. Or not quite as big, but it's big. It's big. And they're hiding them on the back of trucks. That's a lot of highway. That's a lot of trucks. But we tried our best. We took photographs. We examined the car parks. And we looked at the movement patterns of the trucks. And we swooped in on convoys. And we'd rip open the back of the truck. And there'd be nothing there. What's that mean? That there's no missiles in Iraq, or we're just hitting the wrong trucks? You see, we're in a position now that we have to prove the negative. Having postulated the existence of missiles and hypothesized they exist in the back of trucks, the mere fact that we initiate an investigation based upon that hypothesis legitimized the hypothesis. So we're going to be sitting there in Iraq looking for trucks for the rest of our life. That wasn't acceptable to me, so I went back and said, you got anything more other than this truck thing? I said, oh yeah, we got some good stuff. Give it to me, man. So gradually they released their secrets. The missiles were buried underground in the desert to the north, the south, the east, the west of Baghdad. You heard this one before. And Donald Rumsfeld was asked after the invasion where the weapons of mass destruction. He said, I know where they are. They're the north of Baghdad, the west of Baghdad, the east of Baghdad, south of Baghdad. Well, we got the same briefing back in 1993. Where are the missiles? But they also gave us specific locations. Hard information. Where are the missiles? They're buried in the mountains, dug in the tunnels. Where are the missiles? They're wrapped in prophylactic devices and buried in the rivers and lakes. Okay, we're going to call your bluff. Build us a ground-penetrating radar. And I sat down and designed one with the CIA. It cost $12 million. And we put it on a helicopter. We trained in Western United States. And then we went to Iraq and spent 2 months flying over Iraq, going to every single site the CIA gave us. Found nothing. We brought in divers with special equipment, put them into the rivers, put them into the lakes, went to every single site the CIA gave us, found nothing. We went into the tunnels, we went to the mountains, we found nothing. We exhausted every single piece of information the CIA gave us and debunked it all. In November 1993, I go back to the CIA, brief the director and his senior staff. He says, with all due respect, your intelligence was bad. We stand by our original assessment. We have disarmed Iraq. There are no more ballistic missiles in Iraq. CIA director thanked me, ushered me out, kept my boss there. He said, Mr. Ritter's done a good job of investigating. We agree there's not 200 missiles in Iraq. There's 12 to 20, and that number will never change regardless of what you do. Ladies and gentlemen, it wasn't about disarmament. It was about maintaining the public perception that Iraq was non-compliant in order to justify the continuation of economic sanctions to contain Saddam Hussein. The scenario I just painted for you in ballistic missiles played out with chemical weapons. It played out with biological weapons. It played out with nuclear weapons. The CIA knew that Iraq had been disarmed. They just weren't willing to allow that analysis, this truth, to be made public. Because to do so would set in motion events that would lead to the lifting of economic sanctions. And the United States could never allow the sanctions to be lifted because their policy was regime change. Not just the passive regime change of maintaining sanctions, though. It was much more nefarious than that. Remember the same time I was at October 1992 briefing the U.S. intelligence community on the success we had? That same moment, the President of the United States was signing a covert document, a secret document called a lethal finding, authorizing the CIA to use whatever means necessary, up to and including the use of lethal force, to remove Saddam Hussein from power. That's October 92. In November, he had an election, thinking he's going to win. He lost. Bill Clinton comes in. Clinton inherits this policy of containment and regime change. Clinton signs a similar document, telling the CIA to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Clinton accepts the notion that we have to contain Iraq through the maintenance of economic sanctions. Clinton takes it a step further. Remember I talked about this domestic political imperative. That's what's driving this, not national security. Clinton's not too keen on going too forward aggressively with Iraq. In 1994, in the interim election, the Republican Party under Newt Gingrich carries out the Republican Revolution, takes control of the United States of the House of Representatives. And now they use Bill Clinton's unwillingness or inability to get rid of Adolf Hitler, also known as Saddam Hussein, as political ammunition on the home front. So much so that in 1995, President Clinton, looking to the November 96 election, turned to the CIA and said, "You need to up the ante, guys. You need to get rid of Saddam Hussein by June 1996 so that he is not a factor in the summer 1996 presidential election." The CIA saluted smartly and moved forward. How'd they do so? You ever heard that name, Iyad Alawi? He used to be called the interim prime minister of Iraq. Before he entered into a career of Iraqi politics, however, he was a paid agent of the CIA. Iyad Alawi ran a group called the Iraqi National Accord. In 1995, the CIA set up Iyad Alawi and the Iraqi National Accord in Amman, Jordan, and funded their efforts to recruit people inside Saddam Hussein's security establishment. But how do they identify who to get? Saddam's got, he's a tough character, tough cookie. He's got this security apparatus that's very effective. The CIA tried to get into it. It couldn't. But who could? UN weapons inspectors mandated to go anywhere, anytime in Iraq. The CIA took advantage of the UN's mandate, used us as a Trojan horse to gain access to Iraq, to spy on Saddam Hussein, not for the purpose of disarming Iraq, but gaining access to information about the security of Saddam Hussein, which had then fed back to Iyad Alawi's group to prepare for a coup d'etat. A coup d'etat that was scheduled for June 1996, timed to link up with a UN weapons inspection, which was to serve as the trigger for the initiation of military action. The coup failed. The Iraqi government rounded up the coup plotters, and before they executed them, extracted enough information to understand not only what the CIA was up to, but the fact that the CIA had used the United Nations inspection process to facilitate the coup. From that moment on, the Iraqi government, whenever they saw a UN weapons inspector, didn't see somebody trying to disarm Iraq. They saw somebody trying to kill their president, and they were right. Ladies and gentlemen, the weapons inspectors tried to do the best job possible to disarm Iraq. They were never allowed to complete that mission because to complete that mission was inconsistent with America's policy objectives of overthrowing Saddam Hussein, removing Saddam Hussein. Why is this relevant? Isn't this just ancient history? No. Because today when people say, "We didn't know, it was a mistake," that's a lie. A lie. They say the intelligence services got it wrong. I tell you right now, as a professional in the intelligence services of the United States, we get it wrong sometimes, but we don't get it that wrong. We're never that fundamentally wrong. We get it wrong on the periphery, but always at the core, we get it right. The CIA knew the truth about Iraq. I briefed them about the truth about Iraq in 1992 and 1993. They were fully cognizant of the reality that Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed, that 95% to 98% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction had been accounted for, disposed of, destroyed, rendered harmless. That to mitigate against the unaccounted for material, we had put in place the most technically advanced and intrusive on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control, blanketing the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure so that we knew for certain they neither retained weapons of mass destruction or reconstituted weapons of mass destruction. This is the truth, and the CIA knew the truth. But their job wasn't to tell the truth or embrace the truth. Their job was to maintain the public perception that Iraq was non-compliant with its obligation regarding WMD. And so we went to war. We went to war on the basis of a lie. We went to war not only on the basis of a lie, but on the basis of deliberate deception carried out by government officials to their own constituencies. In the United States, if a government official tells a lie in the conduct of his or her own official duty, that is a crime of the highest order. It is a felony. I don't know what the status of lying is in Australia, but I would hope that it would be similar. Nope. Government officials can lie and get away with it? Darn. But the fact of the matter is, the issue of WMD is relevant. It's very relevant, not only in terms of where we go from here, because I'm here to tell you right now, I may not be a structural engineer, but I got it down. When you seek to build something, if the foundation is corrupt, whatever you try to build will inevitably collapse. We're trying to build something in Iraq, but the foundation of our involvement in Iraq is inherently corrupt because it's based on a lie. Everything that's happening in Iraq today is derived from that lie. We never intended to bring democracy to Iraq. That is a reactive policy that was developed after we invaded based on a lie. We never intended to liberate the people of Iraq. That is a reactive policy based upon a lie, WMD. It does matter. We can't sweep this under the rug. We can't let go. This is the central issue when we talk about the involvement of the United States and Australia and Great Britain and other members of this coalition of the billing, also known as the coalition of the willing, that continue to occupy Iraq today in violation of international law. That's why we have to continue to talk about it. That's why we have to continue to put it front and center. It may be inconvenient to those elected officials there, but so be it, because it is convenient to the truth. It is convenient to the rule of law. And it is a critical aspect of how we, the people of representative democracies, function. If we allow ourselves to forget this, if we allow these facts to be swept under the rug, then we cease to function as citizens of representative democracies. Because as I said earlier, it's not so much about voting people into office as it is about holding them accountable for what they've done in your name. And ladies and gentlemen, George W. Bush, Prime Minister Howard, and Prime Minister Tony Blair lied to us deliberately. Now, I want them held accountable to the rule of law, but we also need to engage, initiate the process of debate, dialogue, and discussion, because that's very important. You know, we allow them to intimidate us through fear. That fear is born of our ignorance, ignorance of the facts. Now, I've thrown out some information. I've thrown out some details here that hopefully have stimulated you. So let's initiate that process of debate, dialogue, and discussion by holding me accountable for what I've had to say. It's time for me to stop lecturing, and it's time for you to start asking questions. So thank you very much, and I'll take any questions anybody has in the audience.